Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew, my locks with drops of the night. I had put off my garment, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. And this is the word of the Lord.
Man, last weekend we looked at how the gospel, the good news of Jesus, how it can bring us back into the garden of our sexuality. Right, they can bring about wholeness and restoration when it comes to our sexual brokenness, and can bring us back into the Garden of Eden, where we can at least taste a little bit about what Adam and Eve experienced, where they were naked without shame, right? And so that was last weekend. And whatever you believe about Christianity, whatever you might think about Christian sexual ethics or some of the things you might battle about in regards to you believing in God or believing in Christianity in part because of the way in which we might view sex or teach on sex, what we've been seeing in the Song of Songs is that sex is a godly gift, like a gift from God that is passionate and erotic and beautiful, and it's given to us in the safety of this covenant of marriage. And it's even better than that. When there's brokenness, he can heal. When there's brokenness, he can restore. And so that's what we talked about last week, where we can learn in the gospel again to have sex without shame. That was last week. Now, this week we go east of Eden, right? Last week he kind of brought us back into the garden for a moment, but now the couple goes east of Eden, where we see this so far, just this idealistic couple that's just been fawning all over each other. They can't keep their hands off of each other, right? And we finally see them fight. Isn't that great? Right? We see them fight. And it's kind of refreshing, isn't it? I mean, do you have that one married couple friend where they just never seem to fight? Marriage seems to be bliss. Do you have that friend, right? Don't you hate those people? Or just marriage seems easy. That's what the couple in the Song of Songs has been so far. Like they always end up in the bedroom, every scene. It just, everything seems to be going great. But we get to see them fight, and so that's really good. That's gonna be helpful and refreshing and encouraging to us. One of the most famous fights in my marriage, top five for sure, happened on a date night. This was in the first part of marriage where there was a lot of famous fights. Like the top five were all in the first 2 years of marriage for us, and we were headed to a well-needed date night, and my back wasn't feeling good, so I just went to the medicine cabinet, popped 4 Advil. Right, that was normal back then in my baseball playing days, just popping plenty of Advil, and so I popped 4 Advil, and we head off to Papa Doe for some stuffed shrimp. Yeah, amen. And come on. And so we go to Papa Doe, we sit down, and I'm tired. Like, I can, like, barely keep my eyes open. Heather's getting frustrated. We order. Perhaps there was a refreshment in there that kind of aided to all of this problems. We're arguing about something. I can't even, like, put words together. I don't know what is wrong with me, and she is getting frustrated. We eat quickly, man. It's just one of those dinners. Like, let's get out of here. Let's not waste too much money on this date. And we drive home, and we just go to bed. Right? We just go to bed mad. And I wake up the next morning, and I'm going to brush my teeth, and I open up the medicine cabinet and realize that I had taken 4 Advil PMs, which I thought would get me out of it, but apparently 15 years later almost, it has not gotten me out of that fight. But marriage is fight, right? Marriage is fight. There's conflict in marriage because you have one sinner who marries another sinner, and two sinners don't cancel the sin out, right? It multiplies the sin, right? It multiplies the sin. And so there's going to be conflict in marriage. And so a marriage centered on the gospel is not a perfect marriage, okay? A marriage centered on Jesus will not be a perfect marriage, because a marriage centered on the gospel realizes that while the good news of the gospel is good news, it first tells us the bad news, that we are selfish sinners who think that we should be God. And so when you put two gods together in a room, two gods together in a house who aren't very good at being God, and they war, there's going to be fireworks and there's going to be conflict. And so marriage is not going to be perfect. And so a gospel marriage doesn't have to be perfect, but in a marriage centered on Jesus, a marriage centered on the gospel, it should be a place where there is grace and mercy. It should be a place where sinners find refuge. Amen? That's what the place should be. Not perfection, but grace and refuge for the sinner. And that's going to be, you're going to find a greater love in that marriage than the perfect blissful marriage where it's not all that hard to love them. How hard is it to love the perfect woman? How hard is it to love the perfect man? Godly love is when we love one another and it just doesn't, it's not that easy. Right? My wife, she's seen the worst of me. All right, you guys see what I just put forward, my little vulnerability that I might put forward. Man, that's you're not seeing all of me. She's seen all of me. She's seen the ugliness of my soul, and she still loves me. That's love. All right, that's a godly, gospel-centered, Jesus kind of love. And so marriage, not meant to be perfect. It should be a place, though, where reconciliation, restoration, grace, and mercy should occur. And so that's what we're going to see this morning. We get to see them fight, and it's great. I'm really glad they're fighting, okay? Gives us a chance to talk about it, and then we don't have to hate them anymore, okay? So chapter 5, we'll start in verse 2. She says, I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and my locks with the drops of the night. He wants to be sexually intimate with her. That's what this is saying. Verse 3. She said, I had put off my garments. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? That's Hebrew for I have a headache. I'm tired. I don't want to. Verse 4. My beloved put his hand to the latch and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh. On the handles of the boat, I opened to my, on the bolt, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke, and I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil. Those watchmen of the walls. What we have to do, if you remember, this is a song, and so we've got to figure out what is the poetry saying. Right? We don't have to take all the imagery and try to figure out exactly what it is, but we do need to ask the question, how does this make us feel. That's what songs are supposed to do. They're supposed to make you feel something. And so what does this make us feel? And this doesn't feel the same as the other poetry in the song, right? I mean, before, right, the previous five chapters, they're doting on one another. They're doing this kind of back and forth playfulness thing, and they're loving one another. This doesn't feel that way here at all, right? That's not happening. There's watchmen beating her. I mean, this just doesn't feel the same as other parts of the song feel. This has a different feel, and it's the feel of conflict. And in fact, they're fighting about sex, right? This is a conflict about sex. He says, I think sweetly to her, open to me, my sister, my dove, my perfect one, right? He, if you remember, sister is a term of endearment, so he's kind of laying it on thick here, right? My baby, my boo, my perfect one, I love you, you know? Let's be intimate. That's what he's saying here. And he's laying it on thick, and this gal who, I mean, the whole song so far has not been afraid, right? She is secure in her sexuality. She knows how God has made her. She believes that sex is a gift from God. Her husband loves her and dotes on her. They are not afraid of being intimate at all, and yet here she turns him down, right? She's got a headache. She's ready for bed. She's got her face mask on. This ain't happening, right? This ain't happening. And then something happens in verse 4. He puts his hand to the latch, the door, the latch. This is probably her sexuality, her desires, maybe even her body. And whatever he does, it turns her on. She says, my heart is thrilled within me. And so now maybe she's ready, right? First she turned him down. Now maybe she is ready. But now he's turned over, feeling rejected perhaps, and now they're in this fight. He had turned and was gone. He had turned and he was gone. And then what I think happens in verse 7 is we get a look into her heart, into her conscience, into her mind, her emotional sense, right? If you remember back in chapter 3, she had met these watchmen before where she had gone out into the city where she felt vulnerable, she felt insecure, and we kind of got a chance to see her emotional insecurities and emotional needs, and there even emotional intimacy at play in chapter 3. I think here the watchmen are maybe her conscience. Maybe she feels bad about what she did, about rejecting her husband. This is a battle with her emotions, perhaps. Whatever it is, the feel of it is that she's not in this intimate, safe place of emotional and physical intimacy. Now she's in this place of turmoil. There's a conflict here. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he did not answer. That's conflict. Okay? That's conflict. That's conflict. And for many couples, the conflict can be in this same scenario, where there's maybe a fear of initiating intimacy because there's this fear of rejection that's happened, or the fear of unmet expectations, or being let down, or perhaps one member, one couple is the one that's always doing the initiating, and so the burden of their intimacy falls on them, but this is a ripe context for conflict in the marriage. And what's interesting is that the New Testament speaks to this, this particular scene specifically. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it says this. It says, the husband should give to his wife, maybe you didn't know this was in the Bible, okay? It's crazy. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. Weird word, it's okay. And likewise, the wife to her husband. Verse 4. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does, right? Mutual possession. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This text is saying two things, two really important things. The first is this, that the oneness and unity of marriage means that your body is not your body, it's theirs now. Okay? But their body is not their body, it's yours now. By the way, this is unbelievably groundbreaking in that culture where men pretty much owned their wives. And here, the gospel is saying, no, she owns you too. This is mutual possession and unity. His body is her body is your body, which, by the way, husbands is a pretty good trade, right? Yes, yeah. And that's a pretty good trade, right? My wife gets my big head and bushy eyebrows, and I get her, right? I get her. I had a cousin literally one time tell me, it's like, if you ever went bald, you could do a comb over Trump style with your eyebrows. That's how bushy they are. I was like, thanks, man. Right? She gets that, I get her. It's a great trait. I like this. And so this puts the husband and wife, legit story, this puts the husband and the wife in a position to outserve one another. Because she owns my body and I own hers. What do we do then? What do we do? Well, this gives us an opportunity now to outserve one another. Romans 12 says that in the church we should try to outdo one another in showing honor. That's a scenario, that's a context now where sex isn't the win. Right? Who serves, who honors, who gives, that's the win. And so you can imagine the husband initiates and the wife says, man, I've had a really long day, kids were crazy, I'm really tired, I don't really want to, but I will because I love you. And he says, no, baby, no. No, wait, we can try to get after it tomorrow. I wanna serve you. And she says, No, I wanna serve you though. And they outdo one another in showing honor. That's the context that should happen there, where they seek to outserve the other. Second thing that this text is saying is that intimacy should be frequent. Okay? Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, right? So the Bible would teach in the Song of Songs that sex can be free, right? In the gospel where Jesus, he reconciles and restores sexual brokenness, where he takes away our shame, sex and marriage can be free and beautiful. And also, it should be frequent. That if the husband or the wife were to say, hey, not tonight, I'm tired, I don't feel awesome, cool, they just shouldn't say that the next time. They shouldn't say that the next time. That there should be frequency in intimacy in the Christian marriage for all the reasons that we're talking about in the song over these past couple of months. And we'll talk about this more next week a little bit, just kind of the statistics on Christian marriages and how, not next week, next week's Easter. That'd be a weird Easter sermon. The next week about just how often that's happening in Christian marriages and stuff like that. We'll get a little bit more specific, but the big idea is that intimacy should be regular, should be frequent in the Christian marriage. But listen, 1 Corinthians 7 is not a verse for you to use in your marriage. It is not a verse that you get to use and hold it up over your spouse's head in authority as if to say, look, right, your body is my body. No, that verse is for you. That verse is for you to be reminded that you don't have authority over your body. That the posture for you should be one of self-denial. That's what 1 Corinthians 7 is saying. Because that's what Christian romance and sex is. Because that's what the Christian life is. One of self-denial. Godly sexual intimacy is not about demanding, it's about giving. It's not about taking, it's about serving, because that's what biblical love is, right? Jesus didn't come to be served, but what? To serve. God doesn't demand from us, he gives graciously and lavishly, yes? And that's what biblical love is, that's what true love is, and so that's what the Christian does in the Christian marriage. It's a denial of self, the whole Christian life. Deny yourself, pick up your cross, and follow Jesus, yeah? And so we do that in our neighborhood, we do that in our friendships, we do that in the church, we do that in the bedroom. It doesn't change once we get there. It doesn't change. And so they're in a fight, she's wrestling with it emotionally, I think. Perhaps he's pouting a little bit. And now she's gonna text her friends. Look at verse 8. Seriously, verse 8, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love. I love that she texts her friends here. Wives, be careful confessing your husband's sin and sins to your friends. Be careful with that. Like, you need those kind of friendships. You need to be known in that way. But if you're always doing it, never confessing your own, that's not honoring to him at all, right? And there's a way to do it that is honoring to your husband. Verse 9, they respond, what is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? And so they kind of set her up with a softball here, right? They're basically saying, tell us how great he is. Tell us why you want us to go find him. Tell us why you want to reconcile with them. They're good friends, right? They're setting her up to praise her husband. And so here's what she says in verse 1. She's going to do the same thing that he did to her last week. She's going to work her way down his body and tell us what she likes about him, okay? Verse 1, my beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000, right? He is healthy and young and vibrant and handsome, and she loves him. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. Brother's got good hair is what she's saying. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices. He's got a beard, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. I've been trying to convince my wife that beards are biblical, okay? But it's not my body, so I can't grow a beard. It's really frustrating. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. Man, she loves his kisses, right? That goes back to chapter 1. She loves his kisses. They're better than wine. His arms are rods of gold. Come on. All right, guys, set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. This is a very modest translation of that verse, okay? I'm just going to leave it there. Modest. Verse 15, his legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. So he's got gold arms. He's got golden legs. His appearance is like Lebanon. She says, all of them I like. Choice as the cedars. And then she goes back to his mouth. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Right, so she does what he did last week. She takes an index, she takes inventory of his body, and she says, I like this, and I like this, and I really, really like that. That's what she's doing. And if you remember from last week, this is, in Middle Eastern cultures, is called a wasf. And they would do this at the wedding ceremony, right? They would stand up there at the altar, and they would just kind of praise each other's beauty and sexuality. And Renaissance love poetry was called an emblematic blazon, where you just take inventory of one another in a godly celebration of beauty and sexuality. The Bible isn't prude, right? Sex is a gift. Sensuousness, sexuality is a godly thing. And I love that she reaches out to her friends here to talk about these things, okay? She reaches out to her friends and basically says, hey, last night, man, he wanted to, and I didn't, and I think I was selfish, and I think he might be hurt, and I want to reconcile with my husband because I love him and his golden arms, and will you pray for us, okay? That was her text, and this is important because if we are going to, as Christians, take back the sex narrative in our culture, showing that it's a better story, right? God's story of sex is a better story, then we have to normalize conversations around sex. Or we've got to be able to have these conversations in the church and in our city groups and with our friendships and with our friends. We need to normalize these conversations. We talked last week about sex and shame, and how do we get out of shame? And one way in which we get out of shame is by walking into the light. Right? By not letting shame cast this huge shadow over us, but by being known in the midst of community, in the midst of relationship. 1 John 1, it says this, but if we walk in the light, if we're known, if we confess these things, if we normalize these conversations, as he is in the light, we will have fellowship with one another. You want oneness, you want unity, you want good friendships, you want good relationships, you want to be in a good church, we have to walk in the light, and then we will have fellowship with one another. But here's what it seems to me. It seems to me that there's certain topics, there's certain sins, there's certain shames that for whatever reason, we don't walk in the light out of. That we don't confess, that we don't normalize those conversations, that we don't talk about at all. We should, but there's certain conversations that feel like they're off the table. Why is it that certain things are unconfessable in the church? Why? Racism is unconfessable in the church. You ever hear that? Ever hear somebody confess that? Lust and masturbation, debt. You ever heard somebody confess to having a bunch of debt? Same-sex attraction? Sexual brokenness? We don't talk about those things. And so the people walking in those things then continue to feel ashamed, and they stay in the dark, wrestling through life, not experiencing the life free and full that Jesus has purchased for us. Everything should be safe in the church. If not in the church, where? Where can we be safe? Are we going to go out in the city where the watchmen beat us? Are we going to go out into the world? I mean, where do we go if it's not safe to confess these things in the church? I love my city group. So about 3 years ago, we started a group in our old neighborhood, and then we moved. And so we started this new group in our new neighborhood, and we don't lead it. We got great leaders, but it started right around the time that this series started. You know, we really got thrown into learning about one another, right? What do you think it means, Bob, about grazing among the lilies, you know? So we had interesting conversations right off the bat. There's literally no one in our group named Bob. I just made that up. But we have these, like this just rich group, right? This rich group where there's singles in our group and engaged couples in our group and married couples in our group. There's gal even walking through divorce. We just have this rich diversity of relationship status. And we're talking about these things, and we're having these conversations, and we're at the dinner table, and there's food, and there's glasses of things, and we dialogue back and forth, and we've cried for one another, and we've prayed for one another, and we've laughed together, and we've experienced and talked about all that God has done to restore us and to where He has restored us, and we rejoice in what He's going to continue to heal in us. And it's a beautiful thing, because then we don't have to do any of that alone. We don't have to do marriage alone. We don't have to do dating and singleness alone. We don't have to do divorce alone. We don't have to do sex let me be careful here. We don't have to do these things alone. All right, we can have community. We can talk about these things. We can dialogue about these things. We can walk out of our shame and out of the brokenness together, right? Together. And there's nothing that's unconfessable in that group. That's unbelievably important. There should be nothing off the table in your relationships, right? Brothers should be able to walk into the room at your city group gathering and be able to say, man, I think there's racism in my heart, and I can't even believe that it's there. There should be somebody that walks in, and they should be able to say, man, I've never told you guys this, but I've been walking out this alone. I have same-sex attraction, and it's a battle, and I don't want to do this alone anymore. And you don't try to fix them. You cry with them or her, you pray, you walk with them, reminding them of who Jesus is, what Jesus is going to do. Somebody should be able to walk in and say, man, our marriage is broken right now when it comes to intimacy. Somebody should be able to walk in and say, man, I'm in debt. I keep buying things that I don't need, and I'm not being a good steward of my money, and I'm not being generous. Will you guys pray for me? I'm convicted about this. There should be nothing unconfessable in the church. We need to work to normalize these things, because this is the church of Jesus, the God of grace, the God of mercy. And so when somebody walks in our doors at our city group, or walks in these doors back here on a Sunday, because of the people in here formed by grace, they should be able to breathe in grace. Right? This should just be like sense, man. This is a place of grace and mercy and hope. I can confess these things. I can talk about these things. I don't have to keep these things hidden. Yes? All right, so they're fighting. She loves them. Now they're going to reconcile. But it's crazy, because we don't even see how. We just see the result of their reconciliation. Look at verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and to gather lilies. This is very obviously sexual intimacy. Verse 3, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. That's huge. Circle that. He grazes among the lilies. So we don't see how they make up, we just see the results of them making up, of the reconciliation. That's all we see. But verse 3, the first part of it is key here. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, right? This is the refrain throughout the song, right? I am yours and you are mine. I give myself to you and you give yourself to me. I become a part of you and you become a part of me. This is love, right? This is covenant language. This is covenant love where they are one again. So this is why the makeup sex here is unbelievably important, because that's what it is. It's this symbol, this sign, this picture of their oneness. We are one physically, we're one emotionally, we're one spiritually, and we're one relationally. We are going to reconcile this thing because we are one, right? We're one. And what happens in verse 2, man, here they go again, right? What happens there can't happen unless they reconcile, okay? Sex in marriage without reconciliation will either be manipulative or it won't happen at all. This can't happen unless they reconcile. And so this scene here, it kind of paints the picture of what a gospel marriage should paint, right? That there needs to be reconciliation in the gospel. There needs to be reconciliation in the marriage. Not perfection in the marriage, but grace and mercy that's extended to one another. Right? Jesus didn't demand from us, he died for us. And so in marriage, when there's fighting, when there's conflict, we don't demand, we don't fight, we don't insist on our own way, we don't shout, but through self-denial, we give of ourselves that we might be reconciled. And then sex becomes a picture of that. I give myself wholly to you, and you give yourself wholly to me. Verse 6, back in chapter 5, is a good picture for us of what the brokenness of a relationship looks like. She says, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. That's what conflict in relationships look like. That's what oneness being broken looks like. I have turned and gone. And so the picture that's kind of being painted in the first part of the song, and then the reconciliation happens in the second part of the song, it's kind of like this, where the conflict in the relationship is that you have one person in the relationship, and you have the other person in the relationship, and between them is this gate of sin, this kind of gate of conflict that is between them. They can be lying in the same marriage bed, but there's this gate between them. It's not a wall. Like, they can see each other, they can interact, they can coexist, they can even touch each other, they can communicate at some level, but there's an arm's lengthness to it. Right, there's something hindering their oneness. There's something hindering their intimacy. It's this relational gate of sin that lies between the husband and the wife, or brother in Christ with a sister, or another brother in Christ. There's this divide. Right? Ephesians 2 talks about the dividing gate of hostility. That's what that is. There's a dividing gate of hostility between them. And so then the gospel in a gospel marriage, or the gospel in a gospel church with gospel relationships, provides for us keys to unlock that gate. So the life, death, resurrection of Jesus, the giving of the Holy Spirit gives us these keys to interact in the midst of this conflict, that reconciliation might happen and Jesus can be made famous. And so the Bible gives us these keys. I've got 7 of them, right? 7 keys for reconciling in marriage or in the church. Here's the first one, forgiveness. Right, Matthew 18, Peter asked Jesus, hey, how often do we forgive? And Jesus says what? 70 times 7. Right? Basically means just over and over and over and over. And why? Well, we forgive because Christ forgave us, which means this: your forgiveness of your spouse or your friend or somebody in this church or whoever, your forgiveness of them has more to do between you and God than between you and them. Because God forgave you, you forgive them. Doesn't matter how they respond, doesn't matter what they did, doesn't matter if they hurt you worse than you hurt them, it doesn't matter. Because Jesus forgave you, we forgive them. And it's not blowing off their sin, it's not minimizing it, it's saying, I'm gonna step into this pain. I'm gonna hurt, I'm gonna step into this so that you, and I'm not gonna make you hurt in response. Second one, right? Second key, I love this one, love. Love, but listen to this, 1 Peter 4:8, it says, above all, keep loving one another, right? Strive to keep loving, steadfastly keep loving one another. Why? Because love covers a multitude of sins. This should happen in marriage over and over and over. Love just covering sins. We don't have to work everything out. We don't have to dialogue about everything. We don't have to, right? We don't have to do that. Man, there's just some times where we're just, man, we're just, I'm crabby. And my wife loves me and just covers over that and loves me out of my crabbiness. Love covers a multitude of sins. Now, there are some cover-ups that are evil and there are some cover-ups that are godly. The evil cover-ups are when you're the sinner and you do the covering up, where you're minimizing it. Baby, I was just crabby. What's the big deal? You minimize it, you pretend like it wasn't that big of a deal, you shouldn't be hurt by this, all that, that's evil, that's wicked and selfish. But the godly cover-ups are when you do the covering up of somebody else's sin. Baby, it's fine. It's fine, I get it, you're crabby. I know, I love you anyways. That's a godly cover-up, that's love. That's biblical sacrificial love when we cover one another's sins in that way, right? That's a supernatural love when we do that. Here's the third thing, third key to help us in these relational gates of sin and conflict, confess. James 5, confess your sins to one another. Sometimes we raise the relational gate because of our sin, right? This thing is here because of us. And so just by coming to the gate and saying, this is my fault, baby. Right? Man, I was selfish last night and I rejected you. I shouldn't have done that. Will you forgive me? I'm sorry. Or, I mean, I spoke it in such a way that was just not gentle, not kind. I should have told you that, man, tomorrow would have been a great day. I just wasn't feeling good, but I responded selfishly. Will you forgive me? Sometimes just a quick, honest, genuine confession can help us in the conflicts that we're in, okay? Four, pray. Matthew 5:44, it says to pray for your enemies. Sometimes in marriage, you feel like enemies, right? Sometimes I heard somebody say, yeah, really loud right there, by the way. Maybe a little too loud, right? Sometimes in the church, it feels like there's always that person against you. There's always that person kind of butting heads with you, and they feel like enemies. Okay, Jesus said to pray for them. Sometimes the best thing to do in conflict, when there's something that your husband is doing that's bothering you, something that your wife is doing that's bothering you, is to just shut up and pray. Sometimes the best thing to do, like for me, well, my tendency is to very logically, sometimes with a whiteboard, bring my wife's sins to her. And here's actually the flow chart of how you've hurt me and how you've sinned against me and why I was completely right in every bit of it. Her being much more godly and holy than I am, she'll pray for weeks, months. Sometimes she won't even come to me about it. The Lord will just all of a sudden do something in my heart and I'll come to her and be like, man, I've not been very kind to you lately, have I? Yeah, I've been praying for you about that for like 2 weeks. Oh, thanks. that's just a godly, loving thing to do. Five, serve. Serve. Romans 12:20, right? When your enemy is hungry, what? Feed him. Now, this is the opposite of what we want to do in conflict. In conflict, we want to withdraw and we want them to serve us. No. Serve your enemies. Serve your wife. Serve the person in the church that is continually butting heads with you. Serving one another is basically you coming to the gate and saying, baby, will you open the gate? I want to do something for you. She's probably going to open the gate. You're probably out of that fight at that point, right? So we serve. Six, pursue. Matthew 5:23, if you're offering your gift at the altar, remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go first be reconciled with your brother and then come and offer your gift. The point here is that the onus of reconciliation is always on you. You are to pursue, right? They sinned against you or you sinned against them, you pursue. There's no silent treatment in a gospel marriage. There's no silent treatment in a gospel church. How do we breathe an air of grace when we walk through the doors if there's members in the church that won't talk to each other? That's not grace. That's not grace in a marriage either, but we pursue. Why? Well, because Jesus pursued us. Jesus came after us. We were enemies of God. It was our sin that had separated us from God. It was our sin that had raised up this relational dividing gate of sin between us. And yet he came after us. He came after us. And then finally, confront. Matthew 18 speaks of taking someone else's sin to them. Hey, this is how you sinned against me. This is how you hurt me, and confronting them. Husbands, I've just found experientially in my conversations with you over the years that we're just really bad at this. We're so afraid of stirring the pot, upsetting our wife, seeing her unhappy with us, that we don't ever gently and lovingly and prayerfully and slowly confronting her in sin. I found wives are pretty good at it. Husbands, not so good at it. If her sin is legit, then her sin is ultimately against God. And it is loving for you to go to her gently, patiently, prayerfully, slowly, and confront her in that sin. We gotta be husband enough to do that, to stir the pot a little bit, even if she doesn't like it. Keys to breaking down these gates of conflict and sin between us, that we can experience oneness again. Let me just try to pull the weight a little bit off of your marriage. Let me try to pull the weight off of even your Christian life, your Christian walk. Okay, because this is important. Marriage doesn't have to be perfect. Like, the gospel marriage doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be awesome. The sex doesn't have to look amazing like it does in the Song of Songs. It just doesn't. And ultimately, marriage isn't for your happiness. And that's a really, really good news for you. That's really good news for you. And if you think and you go into marriage thinking that it's primarily for your happiness, you're going to miss out on all of the good things and you're going to crush it. Because the real good things isn't the perfection or the bliss or the great sex or anything like that. The real good stuff of a gospel marriage is the forgiveness stuff. It's the grace stuff, the mercy stuff. It's the true love, the cosmic love, the supernatural love, where we look into one another's souls, see the ugliness, and love each other anyways. That's marriage. That's the true biblical love of Jesus. And so that's the experience that we're after. That's what makes Jesus famous, when we have a marriage like that. It's the same thing with your spiritual walk. Man, if you keep trying to kill it in your spiritual life, you keep beating yourself up over every sin and every time you fail, expecting that you're somehow great and mighty and holy, you're going to miss the good stuff. Take one look at your sin and 10 looks at Jesus. Right? You have the grace stuff and the mercy stuff and the forgiveness stuff to experience when you fall again. I'm not saying holiness isn't important. I'm not saying obedience isn't important. Unbelievably important. But you're not going to get there alone. You're not going to get there on your own. You need Jesus to do that. You need the Spirit to do that. You need a drink of grace and mercy again to do that. You need to know that he actually loves you. That when you fall and when you sin, Jesus sees the ugly parts of your soul and says, I love you anyways. That's going to be what brings about your holiness and compels your obedience. Stop trying to be perfect in marriage. Stop trying to be perfect in this Christian life. It ain't happening. But if we get to taste the grace stuff, man, that's the fun part. That's what makes us different. Anybody can have good sex or a great marriage. Non-Christians can have good marriages. Do you know that? Non-Christians can have good sex. Non-Christians can have good lives. They can have fun and joy. That's what common grace means. The God of the universe has gifted them that, given them that. No, what makes us distinct is that when you walk through our doors or you experience our marriages, you breathe in grace. You experience the love and mercy and grace of Jesus, because he loves us.